A confounding announcement today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. troops are in Syria to support the ongoing battle against ISIS fighters. But today, President Trump claimed victory in Syria and signaled a U.S. withdrawal from the country. People who've been following the Syrian war closely aren't sure what to make of this.
It doesn't totally not make sense, but, you know, to just like tweet, it's time to go home, is insane.
Meanwhile, in Syria, there's fear about what happens after the U.S. pulls out.
This means that something very bad will happen to us.
Plus, a university professor discovers that his name was used as an alias by a member of ISIS. Now he just wants to make one thing clear.
I am the real David Mayer, should anyone ask.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here. The big story today, President Trump on Twitter declaring victory over ISIS. And now the White House is ready to pull all U.S. troops out of Syria. This may be baffling if you follow Syria news. Check this out. General Joe Dunford, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, 2 weeks ago talking about the war in Syria.
I am not at all complacent about the work that remains to be done. So we've largely cleared the physical manifestation of ISIS inside of Syria. That doesn't mean there aren't still thousands of fighters in Syria.
And here's Brett McGurk, the U.S. Special Envoy to the Coalition Against ISIS. He was talking just last week about why U.S. troops are in Syria in the first place.
We also have other interests in Syria. We want to see a resolution to the Syrian civil war through the U.N. Security Council resolution process. And we also want to see the removal of foreign forces from Syria, particularly the Iranian commanded and proxy forces from Syria.
So if confirmed, this decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria would be a dramatic reversal of U.S. policy in the region. So what could it mean?
I'm sorry, I just can't, it's hard to figure out what this man is thinking.
Borzu Daragahi is Middle East correspondent for the British newspaper, The Independent.
Like, I'm confused myself. It doesn't totally not make sense. The timing of it is bizarre. And, the way they're doing it is weird. If it was Barack Obama, he would reserve 15 minutes of airtime. He would explain right. Why he's doing it and sort of give a little bit of an explanation, give a nod out to our partners or stuff like that. You know, to just like tweet, it's time to go home is insane. It's madness.
There's been nothing definitive. We have to make this clear, Borzu, but signals are piling up that the U.S. will be pulling out of Syria entirely and soon. Let's look at the possible consequences of that one by one. First of all, what does it mean for the war on ISIS?
Well, it's probably going to give ISIS a little bit more space, not just because the U.S. troops were, so instrumental in fighting it, but the presence of those U.S. troops and the presence of the U.S. kind of kept everyone in the battle space, in a very complicated battle space up there in northern and northeastern Syria, somewhat on their best behavior, and allowed various forces, including the Kurdish-led forces, as well sometimes as the Syrian regime forces, to concentrate on fighting the last remnants of ISIS. And so what it could mean now is you're going to have a sort of vacuum, and you're going to have these various players in there, including Iranian-backed forces, Russians possibly, Israeli air assets, sort of fighting each other for control of that vacuum instead of fighting ISIS.
And how does that square with President Trump's declaration on Twitter this morning, a declaration of victory against ISIS in Syria?
Well, I think it might be helpful to step back here for just one second. President Trump, not that I'm crediting him with anything, but he inherited a very, very tough situation. This was an Obama policy of supporting this Kurdish-led force that was very hostile to Turkey or perceived as a kind of terrorist threat by Turkey, which is a NATO partner, making this group the main partner in the U.S. fight against ISIS. This was not Trump's decision. This was something that was handed down to him from the previous administration. And many people warned that this was an impossible situation. And so, you already have these cries right now. I was looking to some of my sources of Syrian Kurdish-led forces, and they're calling this a stab in the back and a betrayal of the blood of the martyrs. So I think it's a tough situation. I can see why Trump is looking at this thing and saying, what are we doing there? And I think that the consequences will be really unpredictable if, in fact, U.S. troops do pull out.
The Kurds have relied on U.S. backing for some time, U.S. military backing, to protect them from Turkey. How will they fare if the U.S. pulls out?
Well, I think that we should just even take a further step back and look at like all the players on the battlefield, and they're all kind of delighted that if the Americans leave, you're going to have the Turks happy, you're going to have the Iranians happy, you have the Russians happy, the Syrian regime happy, because they think that they'll have freedom of movement. It would not really fit into the U.S. plan of blocking Iran's ambitions.
So many different considerations here. Borzu, how confident are you that this withdrawal by the U.S. out of Syria will actually even happen?
I would say that, you know, based on the, you know, words that we've been hearing, I'm about 60% confident that it'll happen.
Borzu Dargahi of The Independent speaking with us from Istanbul. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
2 years ago this week, I spoke with Syrian activist and teacher Abdulkafi Alhamdo. He had just climbed aboard a bus to be evacuated from his hometown, Aleppo. The siege of the city by Syrian government forces was brutal. Alhamdo often thought he and his wife and young daughter would not make it out alive. The family has found a new home in Syria's Idlib province. I checked back in with Alhamdo today. He was with his daughter and a new addition to his family, a son.
On this day 2 years ago, I cried as never I did before. Really, it was the worst experience for me ever. We were feeling lost, helpless, maybe because it came after a horrible days and months of siege, of fear, of hunger, of all kinds of horror that you might dream of or that you might see in films. And today, when I look at my children, at my wife, yeah, I see that, okay, I should be happy that they are still alive. They are with me. I'm with them. But nevertheless, my soul, they're still in Aleppo.
Eventually, you settled in Idlib, which is where you are today. And we're hearing today news that President Trump would like to take out, remove all the remaining U.S. forces from Syria. What do you think of that?
Today, Trump announced the withdrawal from Syria. In fact, we don't know if he will do it or not. This means Russia and Iran will be the only powers in the area. And I can't say that I'm not happy because the United States didn't do anything to help us, we who suffered from Russia, who suffered from Assad. And even when we were suffering from ISIS, the United States didn't interfere. So I don't know exactly how to feel, but for sure I don't want Russia and Iran to be the only players in the area. I don't want the whole decision to be in their hands. This means that soon or later, but something very bad will happen to us.
So you're concerned that Trump's announcement of pulling U.S. troops completely out of Syria would make Syrians like yourself less safe?
Look, I can't hide my fears of this decision. Having more power for Iran and Russia in the area, it's dangerous. Millions are going to be in danger, in fact. Even those people who are under Syrian Democratic Forces rule, most of them, they can't go back to Assad. Most of them, they are in danger if Assad, Russia control the area again. We hope that this decision is not a kind of agreement between them and Russia, really, because it's somehow fearful for many people.
Abdulkafi, what would you tell American policymakers if you had the chance?
For me personally, I hope that all powers, all foreign powers in Syria go away. I hope Russia, Iran, Turkey, United States, all of them go away. I don't want our souls to be in the hand of Russia, Assad, and their allies.
Abdulkafi Alhamdo in Idlib, thank you very much for speaking with us and give our regards to your daughter in the background. Thank you.
Thank you.
ISIS plays a role, a somewhat mysterious role, in our next story. It's about a 90-year-old professor of theater history. No, he didn't join ISIS, but someone in ISIS was using his name as an alias. His name and the name the ISIS guy used is David Mayer. The real David Mayer told me that he first got a sense of the problem when he ordered something online and it never showed up.
Well, I had bought a 19th century theater poster on eBay. I have a few of these. I study them. I study them along with the texts and the staging and what I can recover from the plays and the period. And it was returned to the sender. And the sender contacted me and said, I have this problem. What shall I do? I contacted a colleague in New York and I asked her if she would receive the poster for me. And then in a few weeks, when my wife and I were just coincidentally making a visit to New York, I collected it. And there I became much more aware of the labels that the post office used. And the labels returning the parcel to the sender saying that I was an unauthorized recipient.
Just to be clear, you're now back in Manchester in the UK, correct?
That's right, in my study at the moment.
Yeah, so leapfrog for us here. How did you end up discovering that the person you're being mistaken for was a Chechen militant named Ahmed Shatayev, who used to be called David Mayer?
Because my daughter's partner, he was able to navigate the internet, and he found the pages that told me that I was on the list.
This is a watch list, correct?
Yes.
It's not a no-fly list, though.
I'm simply not certain about that, whether I'm on any kind of further restriction because of my name.
So what do you know about this man, Ahmed Shatayev?
Nothing other than that he was killed in a firefight about a year ago. And he is still presumably being monitored by the Postal Service, who don't realize that he's gone.
And is Shatayev, was he formerly named David Mayer?
No, it's just one of many aliases. David Mayer is a fairly common Jewish name, and was probably strategically useful to him to identify him as someone other than a jihadist.
Tell me how your life has changed since you got put on this watch list.
Well, I do some of my research on the internet, and I buy ephemera from the 19th century, and that can be interrupted. Sometimes correspondence from colleagues is either returned or lost. Things don't reach me, but I regularly receive my tax bills from the IRS. So I suppose the main thing about it is that it's altogether unpredictable.
I mean, I'm speaking as a complete layperson here, but it seems like it would be really simple to remove your name from a list. Who have you reached out to try and help your situation?
Well, I initially tried the Postal Service. I then tried my congressman, the 8th Congressional District in Wisconsin. I contacted the embassy in London, and they seemed unable to resolve the matter. Now, just a few days ago, because this story appeared in the British press and now in the American press, I've had a friend in Wisconsin saying, well, perhaps our Senator Tammy Baldwin can help. And she's contacted Tammy Baldwin to see whether she can intervene. But that's early days.
Well, as you say, the IRS knows you are David Mayer. So
yeah, the IRS doesn't have any problem with me.
David, you are a 90-year-old American living in Manchester, UK. How does it feel as a U.S. citizen to be placed on a list like this?
Oh, I mean, it's offensive. I would assume that in ordinary circumstances, I have the same civil rights as any other American citizen. And although I'm at a distance, I try to participate in American life. I still vote. I still have family there. I am an American.
So do you see a way forward here? I mean, are you just going to wait for Senator Tammy Baldwin to kind of sort things out? I mean, what other options do you have?
Well, that may be one way. I'm hoping that the amount of attention that this problem has received may finally embarrass the Postal Service. I don't even need an apology. I simply need to know that my post is no longer going to be disrupted and I'm no longer on a list which identifies me as ineligible to receive mail.
All right. David Mayer, the real David Mayer, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. I am the real David Mayer, should anyone ask. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We reached out this afternoon to Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin to see whether she got that request to help David Mayer, but her office was not able to respond in time for our broadcast. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
Everything's fine, guys.
Remember that? Serena Williams there, the 23-time Grand Slam champion. She was referring to a controversy that flared up over what she wore at this year's French Open. It was a black bodysuit. A French tennis judge later said it was unacceptable and called for a ban. Williams didn't make a big deal about it.
And when it comes to fashion, you don't want to be a repeat offender, so.
But the Women's Tennis Association took note, and now they're updating the rules on a number of things. Here's The World's Alison Herrera.
When it comes to what women tennis players can wear to work,
tennis remains very much
I would say conservative, except the dresses and the skirts are so short that you can hardly call them conservative.
That's sports writer Stephanie Miles talking about the reason French Tennis Federation judge Bernard Giudicelli called out Serena Williams after the French Open last May. A tournament she's won three times.
French tennis officials are saying, sorry, Serena, there's a new dress code next year. French Tennis Federation's president told Tennis Magazine that her outfit at the French Open this year will not be allowed, saying, quote, one must respect the game.
That statement didn't go down so well. Some fellow players and fans called the comments sexist, racist. Tennis great Billie Jean King tweeted, quote, the respect that's needed is for the exceptional talent Serena Williams brings to the game. Criticizing what she wears to work is where the true disrespect lies. It turns out the black bodysuit Williams wore to work that day also had a practical purpose. Williams suffered blood clots after giving birth in 2017, and the leggings helped with circulation.
And certainly with the compressive elements to the outfit, even she could probably even get away with wearing it at Wimbledon, where they are far more strict, if she could prove that she needs it for medical reasons.
But now players won't have to make that argument. The Women's Tennis Association put out a statement this week saying that wearing leggings and compression shorts without shorts or a skirt over them is totally acceptable. It turns out there was never a rule against it. And Miles says, forget the fashion statement. It just makes sense.
Not everywhere they play is warm and sunny. And so they sometimes play late at night.
Players get cold. Leggings keep the muscles warm. Doubles champion Pam Shriver also thinks the rule change makes sense. Shriver played from 1978 to 97. She never wore a cat suit on the court, but she did get reprimanded one time for a clothing violation.
Couldn't be bothered with leaving the court. I didn't need to go to the toilet. I had a jog bra on. I just changed my shirt.
She didn't know it was against the rules.
I mean, eventually you realize there's rules, guidelines, laws, or not laws, but rules in sports that are just outdated. So that was one.
The Women's Tennis Association updated another rule this week. And Miles says it's about something more important than dress code. It has to do with players keeping their rankings after maternity leave.
So now what they've done is they've just given the players a longer period of time in which they can use that ranking to get themselves back to where they were.
This change was also inspired by Serena Williams. She was ranked number one when she went on leave. When she came back 8 months later, she'd lost her ranking. And that affects when, where, and who you play in tournaments. Miles says the old rules basically punish women for having children.
Most of the women on tour who had children waited until their careers were done.
That's what Pam Shriver did.
But during my era, there was very few moms.
Now, women are playing longer and choosing to have families at the same time. In a tweet, Billie Jean King said, I am pleased to see these rules changes at the WTA Tour to continue to protect our players in their workplace and allow them to play at their highest level. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
Okay, let me stay on the sports beat here for a few minutes with a beautiful tale. Radio reporter Shirley Wong put together a story about her late father, Lin Wong, and his friendship with NBA legend Charles Barkley. It aired on WBUR's Only a Game.
Charles Barkley's friends couldn't quite place this mystery guest. He wasn't a basketball player, he wasn't a sports figure, and he wasn't from Barkley's hometown. Here's what I can tell you about him. He wore striped red polo shirts, tucked into khaki shorts, and got really excited about two-for-one deals. He was a commuter. He worked as a cat litter scientist in Muscatine, Iowa. In short, he was everyone's suburban dad. More specifically, he was my dad.
Yes, true story. Shirley's dad really was a cat litter scientist. But I wanted to follow up with her about another part of the story that struck me. Your story really kind of got a lot of attention here in the U.S., but yeah. The comments on Twitter also are really kind of eye-catching. One of them said, this is a huge moment for, quote, Asian dad culture. What did you think when you saw that? And, I mean, maybe you can just tell us what it means.
I mean, sometimes when you're a second-generation immigrant, there's a sort of silence between you and your parents. And it's really, really hard to fill those blank spaces unless you're just sitting them down and asking them the questions that you know you want the answers to, there's always language barrier issues, points of reference that they understand that you might not. But I think there are some funny elements maybe some people might relate to, like the polo shirts or the khaki shorts or 2-for-1 deals, just peak dad things.
And what about other moments in your own father's story that still sit with you?
I remember I had sat him down and asked him about his time growing up during the Cultural Revolution. We probably talked about it over 2 different conversations, and there's so many different details that he just could not convey to me. And now I'll never know really what that experience was truly like for him. I can only try to understand, you know, how it made him into the person that he was.
I'm wondering if, you know, looking at your dad's remarkable friendship with Charles Barkley, whether that's kind of prompted you to think about your own friendships and what has been on your mind.
I just want to be able to grieve a little bit more. So basically, when my dad was terminally diagnosed, I set up a Facebook group asking my closest friends to send me different letters, to send me notes of care, and to send me book recommendations. And I've always just loved knowing that other people are thinking and collectively mourning alongside me, because, I mean, who doesn't want everyone to know how special this person was? So, you know, I'm really lucky that so many people are thinking of him.
Shirley Wong, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for your time.
A quick note now about a story we're working on for tomorrow's show about a surveillance system for the U.S.-Mexico border, a kind of electronic border wall. It tracks people on the move. A reporter put on virtual reality goggles and watched a test of the system.
And it said, oh, 98% probability that this thing is a person. You could zoom in or even send a drone to look at it. You could see it's a person.
A virtual border wall that's coming up here tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. Remember that photo of the Central American woman running from tear gas at the U.S. border with her daughters? After it went viral, she got some unwanted attention.
There was a right-wing extremist group that started targeting her in Tijuana.
Now Maria Meza is in the U.S. An update on her story that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. You might remember seeing a photo of a family from Honduras along the Mexican border. It went viral. You heard about the mother and her 2 children here on The World. We have an update now. The setting, you'll recall, was the U.S.-Mexico border near Tijuana. In the background, a long barbed wire fence, a crowd of migrants, and smoke from tear gas canisters fired by U.S. Border Patrol. In the chaos, a woman runs away from the tear gas, clutching her 2 young girls. That's the moment that was captured by a Reuters photographer. The woman in the photo is Maria Meza. Volunteer lawyer Carol Lynham was with Maria and her children at the U.S.-Mexico border earlier this week. Carol, what's Maria Meza's current situation? Where is she now?
She has an attorney who is locating her and her children right now, but she is in the United States and was allowed to process in for her request for asylum.
You were with Maria and her children and other migrants. It was Monday night going into Tuesday morning, waiting for their asylum cases to be processed. What was that experience like?
We arrived at the Otay Mesa port of entry at around 2:45 with 15 asylum seekers. And we did not leave until 8 a.m. the next morning. And that was because Customs and Border Protection was not going to allow them to ask for asylum. We also had 2 members of Congress with us, and we're advocating that these asylum seekers be allowed to request asylum. We were on U.S. soil the entire time. So these were people that were technically already in the United States requesting asylum.
That Reuters photo of Maria and her children, how much did that endanger her, like all the attention?
Quite a bit. There was a right-wing extremist group that started targeting her in Tijuana. It was a woman on Facebook, Paloma for Trump, who would direct them to come to Tijuana and harass her and her family. It wasn't safe for her in Tijuana, so her and her children couldn't wait for their number to come up on that list.
And Representatives Jimmy Gomez and Nanette Barragan, both from California, how did they expedite the process?
They were there with us at the border from the beginning. They were there talking to CBP. Having them there was great. They were really able to advocate and bring that kind of oversight that it's harder for, certainly for asylum seekers to ask for when they are simply turned away, which we did see happen with that family of five, that maybe the world's luckiest family that happened to walk up to the port of entry while we were all standing there, asked for asylum, and then came and stood with us while we happened to be there.
What time of day was that?
It was dark, but it wasn't late. So this family of five, they had just came from Honduras. They simply happened to go to the border that exact moment, ask for asylum, and we happened to be there. So it was their very lucky day. They happened to be there when we were there.
So, I mean, you're a volunteer lawyer. You're there kind of as a witness. I mean, what was your interaction like with the children, both of that family and of Maria Meza's family?
We got there at 2:45. It's winter. You know, the sun sets pretty early. It got cold. There was no bathroom. So those kids were asked to do something really hard, and they were getting restless. They didn't really know a lot about what was going on. We chatted about birds in the sky and that kind of stuff. But it was kind of extraordinary to have those kinds of conversations with a child in such intense circumstances because there was so much going on.
Did Maria ever think she would get rejected for her asylum claim? And how did she talk to her kids during this long wait while all this is going on?
She was very calm. You know, she's been through a lot. She didn't get called back for processing until about 9 or 10 p.m. And we had no warning she was going to be called. They literally just walked out. They walked out with handcuffs, the white plastic kind. It was unclear if they were going to handcuff her, what was going to happen. But, you know, it was very peaceful, very quiet, and very fast. Lots of hugging, lots of tears, because a lot of people had put a lot of effort into making sure that she stayed safe.
And who were those handcuffs for?
They ended up being for nobody. They used more increasing intimidation techniques throughout the night after that. They put a fence around us. They came out and videotaped us with their cell phones. They just kind of made it more and more uncomfortable. And plus, it got colder and colder.
Yeah.
But we all stayed up all night, and including the members of Congress.
You're about to leave California to return to your practice in Minnesota. What are you taking away just like emotionally from this whole experience?
It's really difficult. You know, you read in the news about the asylum ban, but to actually see asylum seekers not only turned away from asking for asylum in direct violation of our own laws, but also to see how they treat people when they have six lawyers, two members of Congress, media. They're still made to sit and sleep on the pavement, making a three-year-old sleep on the pavement. It's interesting to see how CBP can act like this, even when there's so much light shown on it. It really makes me think about what's happening when there's not light being shown on these things.
Volunteer lawyer Caroline in San Diego telling us the latest news about Maria Meza and her two kids, the family that was photographed at the U.S.-Mexico border in the process of getting tear gassed. Cara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
No new money for the border wall. That's the likely outcome of this week's last-minute budget brawl between President Trump and Congress. But wait, the Trump administration wants to reach across the border to help address the causes of migration. The State Department is now pledging more than $10 billion, billion with a B, to support a development plan by Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, a.k.a. AMLO. Reporter Emily Green is with us from Mexico City. López Obrador announced his plan last week, Emily. How has he described it?
So he says it's going to be $30 billion over the next 5 years that will be invested in southern Mexico and Central America. He calls it an initiative to welcome migrants into Mexico with visas, healthcare, and employment, and that it will also help stem the tide of migration from Central American countries and hopefully stem the tide of these kinds of massive migrant caravans that we have seen cross through Mexico over the last couple of months.
Yeah, so López Obrador calls his plan a Marshall Plan. It sounds like he sees really big things for this.
Right. I think that he wants to be a leader in the region in terms of shaping the region and being a force for regional stability. But the devil really is in the details. And I'm just going to give you an example. For example, it seems that a large portion of that $30 billion is going to go towards a project that he calls Train Maya. And it's a tourist train that would go around the Yucatan Peninsula and around the big Mayan ruins. And that project is worth $7.4 billion over the next 4 years. The thing is, this is a very controversial project, and many environmentalists are opposed to it. So right off the bat, he says $30 billion towards southern Mexico and Central America, and $7.4 billion of that is going to a controversial project that environmentalists oppose.
Where is this $30 billion estimated? Where is it going to come from?
Good question. I think we don't really... No. I mean, AMLO insists that the money is in the budget. And I talked to Duncan Wood. He's head of the Mexican Center at the Wilson Institute. And I asked Duncan Wood, you know, where is Andrés Manuel López Obrador? Where is he going to come up with the money? And here's what he had to say.
It is very difficult to see how he can come up with the money, or he, his government, the private sector can come up with the money, or even Mexico, the United States, their governments and their private sectors combined. That's just simply not going to happen.
So I talked to Duncan before the State Department's announcement, and now we have a better idea of where the money's going to come from. It's going to come in the form of loans. It's not really going to come in the form of government aid.
And Emily, is this intended to be real money, like available now, or is it money that's going to have to be kind of taken from Peter to pay Paul?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a ton of money. The State Department says $10.6 billion. The truth is that the only real new figure appears to be $4.5 billion of that $10.6. The rest of the money already exists. It's already being spent, already going towards investment in southern Mexico and Latin America. And that $4.5 billion is not new aid. Again, it's loans. And that is a big difference. And I think that it's something that should be really clear when we're talking about what this Marshall Plan looks like. Because, of course, the Marshall Plan in World War II was aid money. And that is not what's happening right now.
What else is in the plan that you see could potentially benefit, like, the working class of Mexico and working class Central Americans?
I don't want to be too unspecific here, but the truth is we really don't know what's in this plan. I mean, AMLO hasn't clearly stated where the money's going or where it's coming from. And another possibility of where the money might go is towards a refinery in AMLO's home state of Tabasco that's worth $8 billion. So right there, you have $7 billion for the train, $8 billion for a refinery, both of which environmentalists are not too keen on. And I haven't seen, as far as I know, AMLO say exactly how he's going to invest money in Central America. To this point, it seems to me that he's basically relying on the United States. And that was the package that was announced yesterday that, in fact, is not an aid package.
That's reporter Emily Green in Mexico City telling us about the new Mexican president's so-called Marshall Plan. The U.S. State Department just pledged support for the plan. The Uyghurs, an ethnic group in China. They may not be a household name in the U.S., but they become a talking point for the White House. Here's Vice President Mike Pence a few weeks ago.
Survivors of the camps have described their experience as a deliberate attempt by Beijing to strangle Uyghur culture and stamp out the Muslim faith.
Pence is talking about prison camps in northwest China, where many Muslim Uyghurs are imprisoned. This is in the province of Xinjiang. It's a place where the Uyghurs have a long history. We've been reporting on the situation with these detention camps on the world. China is holding as many as 1 million people in them. China denies the allegations. But many Uyghurs who have fled their homeland want world leaders to take action. Like many communities in exile, though, there's disagreement about what action to take. The world's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Aydin Anwar was born in the U.S. after her parents won asylum and settled in the D.C. area. Her dad has long fought for Uyghur rights. Most of their extended families still in China, and many have disappeared.
We don't know where they are.
They've been missing for years.
We don't know, you know, if they're alive or dead. We have no way of contacting them.
And no one seemed to know about it until this past summer. A United Nations panel reported that China had turned the region into a massive internment camp. Satellite images showed facilities like prisons with watchtowers. China called them re-education camps for vocational training. More reporting exposed a system of forced labor.
people in these camps are being forced to renounce their faith, adopt atheism, and pledge allegiance to the Chinese state as a god, lethal injection, forced sterilization, torture, bodies being cremated in order to hide the evidence of bodies coming out. These are all signs of a looming genocide.
So Anwar, a Duke University student, has thrown herself into activism with what's called the East Turkestan National Awakening Movement. East Turkestan is the name many Uyghurs call their homeland in China. Salih Hudayr started it last year. He says he has more than 80 relatives missing.
The only way that we can ensure our freedoms and our human rights is by restoring our independence. That's the only way that we can ensure our overall survival as a whole.
Calling for independence is controversial among older, established Uyghur groups.
I don't know why they're opposed to the idea of us advocating for independence. They say that it's unrealistic or that the international community will stand against it. The United States will oppose it, which is nonsense.
The disagreement's causing a split. The new group has been shunned by established Uyghur organizations.
Ideally, we tried to work with them. In fact, the fact that they weren't willing to work with us is what caused us to come out as a different organization.
They are younger.
Ishat Kakbura is president of the Uyghur American Association. He says older generations of the Uyghur diaspora have already tried many different ways of approaching China.
You can't do anything else. We know that. We tried all other means. It didn't work.
Kakbura came to the U.S. as a refugee in 2006. He says everyone wants independence, but first, there are priorities.
We want first to save these people from the concentration camp. They need to be alive.
He says he hasn't heard from his sisters or his mother for 3 years now.
I want my government at least to find out where is my mother. It's unbearable.
Kakbura is grateful for the efforts of U.S. politicians. He calls GOP Senator Marco Rubio his personal hero for demanding investigations of Uyghur camps. But Kakbura says so far, there's been no action. And that sends a signal to Beijing.
The Chinese government is calculating it. They're watching it.
The younger Uyghur group wants the U.S. and the U.N. to label what's happening in China as genocide and send in peacekeepers. They're planning to demonstrate in front of the White House tomorrow to mark the anniversary of the day in 1949 when Uyghurs say China occupied their homeland. Anwar, the Duke student, says she's glad more Americans will probably know why Uyghurs have fought for freedom for so long.
Like, I'm still trying to be grateful, you know, like, and use the voice that's been given to me and the freedom for me to speak out for the people who are being blocked off from the entire world and are being ignored and slowly put to death.
Anwar says she'll play her part, just like her dad did. For The World, Rupa Shenoy.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Many Cambodians here in the U.S. last saw their home country back in 1975. The movie The Killing Fields dramatized the chaos there as Americans and some Cambodians managed to flee. The Oscar for Best Supporting Actor in 1984 went to Hang Ngor. He played a Cambodian journalist who was not evacuated. In his Oscar acceptance speech, he said it was important for Americans to know the story.
And I thank Warner Brothers for helping me tell my story to the world, let the world know what happened in my country. And I thank God, Buddha, that tonight I'm even here. Thank you, man. Thank you.
That fabulous moment for the Cambodian-American community sits in sharp contrast to some news today. The U.S. is sending Cambodians home. Kevin Lowe is an attorney for Cambodian deportees, including some who landed in Phnom Penh today.
I think one of the more compelling stories is one of my clients who actually barely missed getting on the plane, and his name is Sir Un. So Sir was, like many of the other refugees on the plane, they came here in the mid-1970s. The Vietnam War had just spilled into Cambodia. The U.S. was dropping bombs on the country. They all fled. Once they got to the U.S., many of the Cambodian refugees, and Sir included, were resettled in neighborhoods that were just over-policed and filled with gangs and violence. Sear ended up committing a residential burglary in his youth. I think he was probably like 18 or 19.
And that's one of the connecting threads with all these stories, is that these are people who at one point got into trouble with the law.
Yes. So across the board, they have convictions, most of them from about two decades ago. And these are crimes for which they have fully served their sentences. It's just that after they exited prison or county jail, ICE was there to pick them up and put them in removal proceedings.
So for those who were convicted of felonies decades ago, deportable felonies, why weren't they deported when they first got out of prison?
So prior to 2002, Cambodians who were ordered removed were not accepted by Cambodia. So actually, Cambodian clients we've talked to have all had the experience of being in an ICE jail, just getting advice from like the random detainees that they knew. And at that point, it was good advice to just take a removal order to not fight your deportation, because Cambodia wasn't accepting people. If you were willing to accept a removal order, they knew that they would just get out and would be able to live their lives. So many of my clients have been out for another like two or three decades.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, they're really part of the country then, right?
Yeah, they have careers, they have families, and they totally thought that they kind of left that behind. Like, they've just started new lives, and they're very different people.
There is a suggestion that there are as many as 1,800 plus Cambodians on a list with the final deportation order. What has been the reaction from some of your clients when they find out that they're going to be on that plane?
So this is something that ICE has been doing every 4 months since October of 2017. They pick up 100 people each time. And obviously, the community has reacted with a lot of fear. There's a lot of anxiety. Even Cambodians that aren't picked up know that they will eventually be on the list, essentially. ICE recently made a statement saying that Cambodia should prepare for around 200 deportations each year. And this is still a community where people are very much unable to get legal representation. And it's somewhat surreal that ICE is often arguing in court with us that these poor families that are trying to survive on food stamps should essentially have a lawyer on retainer that they check in with to see if the law has changed on their cases, because that's often one of the only ways that we can prevent their deportation, is by seeing if their convictions are no longer deportable. Like my client Sir Un that I mentioned before, his residential burglary is no longer a deportable offense. Like, the Supreme Court has said so, the Ninth Circuit has said so. We got him a stay just 2 days before the flight left, and he's waiting on a pardon from the governor, because even with his one conviction, which is not removable, ICE could still deport him on the next flight if he doesn't get his case reopened. Like, if a judge doesn't agree that he merits staying in the U.S. And kind of the horrifying thing is that out of the people that we talk to that are picked up in each raid, we find that probably more than half of the people are not removable. They have very strong options to reopen their cases and that they should be able to stay here. It's just that they don't have the resources to do so.
So, I mean, how do you see your clients in the U.S. coping with the reality they're living with now, that after living here for decades, they could be deported at any moment?
I think it is a immense sense of helplessness. It's not like they can go anywhere. Their lives are here. Many of them have never been to Cambodia. Like, their parents fled before they were even born. So they were born in the refugee camp. They don't necessarily speak the Khmer language even. So this is their home, and any family members that they had in Cambodia have either died in the genocide or they've come here. So if they go back to Cambodia, they essentially have no one that they can rely on.
Kevin Lowe there. He's an immigration attorney with the Asian Law Caucus. You can see an essay he wrote about being an immigration attorney at theworld.org/Cambodia, an item originally published by the Asian American Writers Workshop. Okay, I'm going to change lanes now real quick.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase.
Hakuna Matata. Ain't no peasant craze.
Hakuna Matata from Disney's The Lion King. It means no worries in Swahili. Maybe Disney should be worrying. More than 50,000 people have signed a petition accusing the company of stealing the phrase, a common expression in East Africa. Activist Shelton Mpala is behind the petition. He says it's about more than words.
I think the biggest thing is just really to bring awareness of trademarking in Africa, because not a lot of people understand what trademarks are and how they work.
Disney actually trademarked the phrase Hakuna Matata in 2003, and Mpala thinks this is an example of modern-day colonialism, big corporations like Disney co-opting ideas and even language from African countries.
No protections have ever really been put on any specific things, such as language, terms. So I think that the biggest thing is really on the awareness that as Africans, we need to protect our culture, our heritage, and our languages.
Shelton Mpala there. We reached out to Disney for comment, but we are yet to hear back. And here's a fun fact. The Swahili phrase, Hakuna Matata, was itself popularized by this song that came out in 1982. That's 12 years before Disney's Lion King. The tune is Hello Mister by the Kenyan band Them Mushrooms. And with that, it's time for me to say goodbye to all of you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. Thanks for listening. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org. PRI 2020 donors, including the Roger Horchow family, whose members believe in fairness and objectivity in news reporting, and Marguerite Steed Hoffman, who values journalism and storytelling that reach across our divides to create a more informed and connected world, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and the Candida Fund for furthering the values that contribute to a healthy planet, and by the Ives Family Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.